So let's see, I'm Rick Hansen. It's April 19th, 2017. And as you know, probably, we've been focusing on relationships in here. And I want to continue tonight talking about different kinds of triggers of craving, broadly defined, problematic drive or desire in relationships. But before I go there, I just want to pick up on some of the suggestions I offered during the meditation and just kind of remind you or flag again some key words I used and to see if you have any question about them, maybe briefly, and then I'll slide into my more general topic of relationships. Let's see, if you were there for the 2:645 and about 7 o'clock when I offered suggestions, I talked about letting your body come to rest and your mind come to rest, and letting the mind altogether find its resting state. And I mean mind in terms of experience, this moment of consciousness in a fairly simple, not esoteric sense, hearing, seeing, remembering, thinking, fantasizing, with awareness mixed into it. Okay. And so I talked about letting mind altogether come to its resting state, and then I referred to being awake, present, open-hearted, content, and at peace. These are pointing out instructions in the sense of finding that or opening to that or encouraging that. And they're also suggestions for, you know, nudging, helping the mind in that direction and returning to that place. That's a very fundamental mode of practice, and if nothing else, it's fairly or can be relaxing and centering and training, because the mind takes its shape from what it repeatedly rests upon. The brain takes its shape from what the mind repeatedly rests upon. So that's a centered, calming place. And what becomes increasingly available as that stabilizes is a kind of letting go of problem, a kind of letting go of any sort of struggle, and a growing sort of abiding as mind as a whole. Good stuff. With a sense of insight, vipassana, into the nature of mind experience as insubstantial, empty in the technical sense, and not to be clung to in any way. Okay? So, any questions? Pretty clear, okay with that? You know? So, it's especially awake, so there's an alertness, present, mindful in the present moment, open-hearted, relational, loving kindness, flowing in, flowing out, open-hearted, content, no seeking for more, and peaceful, at peace, not at war with anything, inside the mind or outside the mind. Okay? I like that progression myself.
I got that, but then the next thing I didn't get. There was something after that.
Right. Huh. That I was just speaking to you right here?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a traditional teaching, and I feel I would be remiss if I didn't point to it or acknowledge it. It's initially sounds, it's hard to talk about and can sound kind of woo-woo. And a person can feel, I don't get it. I'm missing out, something wrong with me. No worries. It's a progressive process. Basically, if you're just there, right? So it's not even so much that you're there. It's just that there is there. Right? Mind keeps on going. Minding, the mind process, right? That seems incontrovertible. There is hearing, there is remembering, there is thinking, there is noticing thinking, there is the point of view about noticing thinking. Ooh, then there's mind altogether again. Right? So far? Mm-hmm. In that, there can be a really useful kind of repeated insight or observing, just observing, that, there are a lot of parts of mind. There's a sound here. There was my thought about the sound there. There's my judgment about my thought about the sound there. there's the reminder of Rick's voice in my head, disengage from all that, don't follow it, relax. You know, all these parts. I think of it a little bit as like the surface of a glass of fizzy soda water, bubbling water. All these little bubbles, pop, 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 overlapping each other, coming and going. Maybe over time, the surface of the soda water settles down. Even then, you know, short of, you know, profound states of meditative absorption, there's still an ongoing pop, 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 pop. So there's an awareness that there's pop, 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 which seem like parts, and yet there's a whole in which parts are occurring, interacting with each other, and growing more intense or maybe settling down, right? You observe that directly. And then what can happen is as the just sitting or choiceless awareness, two different terms for more or less the same state of being, I think, as that stabilizes, periodically there's a kind of sense of just being the whole thing, the whole mind process, as it is. Often then what happens is you notice you just noticed it, and then that's another part. That's another piece of content separated out from the rest of mind as a whole. But that's okay. But that's often how it happens. You kind of settle into it, then you think about settling into it. The thinking about settling into it is not it anymore. You've popped up out of the sea into the wave, right? Then you notice, then another part of you notices that, oh, the wave happened. And then there can be a kind of calming and settling back down into being the sea, or my other metaphor, being the water as a whole, in which bubbles occur. Okay? That process of moving back and forth from part to whole is very supportive of a growing equanimity. Because then, increasingly, you recognize, oh, parts arise. You know, thoughts arise, reactions arise. They all have the same structure. They're all parts of the whole. Conditioned, they arise, they exist, they pass away. And increasingly, with this kind of recognition, part, 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 you get less, the bubbles seem less and less important. The waves seem less and less important. You know, it's nice to encourage good ones, but we increasingly have an equanimity about the waves that come and go, the pleasant ones, the unpleasant ones, the neutral ones, the heartfelt ones, they come and they go. And with that, that supports a growing resilience in the face of the waves of life that bombard us. We establish more and more of a stable core of a resilient happiness inside ourselves, kind of no matter what's happening. All right? So far, so good?
Yes.
And then, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. I just feel like I have a duty to name it, you know? It's like, but, you know, then there can be some curiosity about, wow, what's the nature of this mind, this experience that's occurring, this experiencing that's unfolding, this mind process? You get, there's a curiosity about it. And whoa, wow. So, it's insubstantial, right? It has a boundlessness to it in the sense that there's no edge to it, no bound. I don't mean in some cosmic consciousness sense, I just mean phenomenologically. You're like, oh. And it doesn't seem to have a director or an owner. Ah. Selfing starts fading with that, right? And also it seems like it just keeps on going, and trying to hook on to some piece of it feels tense and futile. So that supports less and less clinging. Right? Okay? And you kind of read about this, as I'd have, and then you go, oh, wow, I sure like to experience that. And then gradually you start to experience it, and that stabilizes. That's cool. All right? And then the last one, sort of, for me at least, how I relate to this, you know. You start noticing parts coming and going. You're mindful of this, mindful of that. Then there's a growing interest in mind process as a whole, mind as a whole, including its awareness aspects. And nothing's left out, right? Awareness itself is part of the mind process. The sense of I, that has a perspective about the mind process. It's just part of the mind process, right? In an infinite regress, thoughts about thoughts about thoughts about the mind process are just part of the mind process, as best we can gather. Okay? Okay. So, now you're out there, mind is all, and you just start going, wow. Is it possible that this clearly endlessly conditioned movie, as it were, which is embedded in biology and life, the brain, the body, the nervous system, life altogether, also embedded in culture. You know, the thoughts we're having are very much like the thoughts other people are having. The mind process here is a lot like the mind process there. Mind process there is a lot like the mind process there. Right? There's mind, see, like do-do-do-do, okay? And to come to the end of this all, you know, you can start to have this sense of, wow, it feels like there's some kind of freedom or unconditioned space or something or other, always just prior to the next frame of the movie. Now, maybe that is just an intimation of the fertile noise in the substrates of consciousness in the brain. Right? Which just kind of, they're alive, they're sort of firing, neurons are firing, neurochemicals are flowing, but it doesn't mean anything. It's not carrying any information. There's no signal. It's just fertile noise. It's just waiting to represent the next thought, the next bubble in the surface of the jar of glass of soda water. Right? So maybe that's what we have an intimation of. When we sense, there's always something that's a space of possibility because it's unconditioned noise. It's not yet conditioned into meaning or signal or form of some kind. Right? Maybe that's the space of unconditioned possibility, like a whiteboard or chalkboard upon which nothing is yet written, right? Maybe that's all we intuit. But even that is pretty fantastic, a sense of possibility always just prior to the next conditioned actual sound, sight, taste, touch, smell, thought, right? I definitely feel like we need some fresh air for this part. And it's also possible that in addition to what we know from a third-person perspective is actually truly the case, the fertile noise in the neural substrates of consciousness, just waiting to represent the next thing. By its nature, effectively unconditioned, because it's like it could represent anything, all right? It's conditioned in the sense of being in the body, those neural substrates, but they're effectively unconditioned from an experiential standpoint, always just prior to the next thing. And therefore, there's a freedom in it, and a possibility, and a lightness in relationship to the forms that are appearing in the mind in this moment. Pretty cool. Like, you look at people who are talking about reverse engineering awakened mind. And awakened brain. People who are really far along, and as you progress, you feel lighter and freer, while the heart opens wider and wider and feels the pain of the world even more keenly. What? Right? How do you put those together? But there is that sense of freedom and lightness and non-attachment and the capacity to get off positions faster, be less attached to certain things. Okay? All right? It's also possible to finish this, which maybe I'll just do the whole talk on this, I don't know. But anyway, it's possible, you know, and there could be an intimation that it's not just the biological random access memory space in the neural substrates of consciousness that's just fertile noise, but actually there's something unconditioned, deathless, inherently transcendent that we start to have an intimation of when we're kind of as close as we can possibly get to the emergent edge of the next moment of mind. So I'm not asserting dogmatically that there is such an unconditioned. I will assert dogmatically that our best guess is that the Buddha asserted that, and other saints and sages have asserted that as well. It is my experience and reason that there is that unconditioned, deathless, transcendental aspect. And then what the qualities of that transcendental, deathless, unconditioned aspect of ultimate reality might be, different religions, different teachers, different traditions, different individuals have a different sense of that. But the possibility of possibility, right? The possibility of radical possibility outside the natural frame is something that a person can have a very meaningful sense of. All right, I did digress. And I'm going to end at 8:30 because I'm attached to seeing the Golden State Warriors play tonight. Rob.
I was thinking about this recently, actually, strangely, or not strangely.
Knowing you, no surprise.
In writing a little bit about it, a little essay, but I called it the curiosity of survival. That place that is can be anything. My way of looking at it is it can be curious about anything.
Okay.
It's the next second, the next moment, the next breath. But it's a survival mechanism, because the creatures that don't have that, they're not here anymore. Right? They weren't curious enough to breathe, to think, to take a step, to join with others. So I find that a curiosity of what is next?
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Similar.
Yeah, that's great.
Curiosity of survival.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, great, Sylvia.
I just want to know if I'm doing this properly. Boundless awareness beyond thoughts, meaning that you personally and beyond the thinking mind. So pretty much it's like meditating where you bring your center to the heart, or you breathe in through the nose and keep your breath there, and then you kind of go into that boundless awareness, like the mind field with no thoughts, period.
Sounds great so far. Excellent, 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 excellent.
Okay, I could get to that state. Now, what I can't get to, and I can see they're pretty long, because pretty much Catalans do that. Spaniards were taught that. They're all like real quiet, and you know, it's traditional. But like I said, the Westerners are a lot, they're newer, they're not old years and years back. So what I'm trying to say is, on the edge, I can't seem to get the, how would you say it, where you're so conscious awareness, where you're open-minded, where that's where you're not having problems, and you're just fresh. I can't do that all the time, because I get into that little rut, and then I have to come present again, but it's like work.
Well, I think you just summarized, you know, like the fundamentals of, you know, the process of self-actualization, especially the more spiritual aspects of it, let's say, even without reference to anything transcendental. Sure, no, I think first, good practice, you know, and that process of coming back again and again and again is very key. As you've heard me quote, traditional Tibetan teacher describing his own path of awakening, he said, in the beginning, nothing came, you know, nothing beneficial or wholesome came. In the middle, nothing stayed. I think most of us are in various versions of the middle phase. And in the end, nothing left. But actually, if you think about it, I think it's important to give ourselves, in some sense, credit, because lots of things don't leave anymore as people progress in their own healing and development and awakening. Certain attitudes, certain perspectives. So even if we're not yet at full awakening, whatever that might be, lots of wholesome qualities have stabilized. And the absence of lots of problematic qualities of mind has also stabilized.
So I'm still working on the selfless and the selfish of not grabbing that from the external.
Right.
And just because, you know, they say it's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, that the selfless and the selfish, they're externally trying fast enough. Where you go beyond that and you're at the boundless awareness state. We're not grabbing anything externally, but it's kind of a bliss.
Right. That's right.
That. But I mean, you know, when they're in an environment and everybody's at a different
Yeah.
It's hard to see like that sometimes.
Oh, yeah. And if y'all are okay with it, that'll be a really good segue to talk about, as Jean-Paul Sartre put it, the hell that is other people. Okay? So that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about how to balance, as we started getting into, see my segues here, from last week and the week before, you know, when is desire helpful and useful, broadly defined? You know, we care about certain things, we have wishes of certain kind, including to protect ourselves. When is that helpful, beneficial, and so forth? And also, when do we tip into trouble? What's the transition? What's the boundary zone there, let's say? So last week I talked about becoming mindful of when we get tipped into a drive state, which is the modern version of craving, that is the second noble truth in Buddhism that is the source of so much suffering and harm. All right? So I want to call out, just in the interest of time, I'll do it kind of concretely and quickly, to give you maybe something concrete that's interpersonal, in addition to that, you know, progression I talked about, you know, in which you start opening up to the deeper end of the pool, and reminding you, if I could again, that which you might use for yourself in your own meditative practice or in life, kind of five words, sort of simple: awake, alert, you know, awake, present, open-hearted, content, and at peace. Not forcing it, not imposing it, more opening up to it, valuing it, taking in the good, receiving it, and allowing it to establish itself increasingly in oneself. Okay. So, craving in relationships, tipping into a drive state, getting driven about something, I want to look at that through the lens of the four classic objects of attachment that the Buddha taught, and apply that to relationships. So it could help to think of a complex, tricky relationship that's not all white light and butterflies and chocolate chips, of course. Or think about a current kind of wrangle with someone, or a recurrent, you know, edge, conflict, tension, something. Okay? It'll help to make it concrete. So the four classic objects of attachment that the Buddha, you know, pointed out, he kind of named them, and then he said, essentially, see for yourself. The first one's called sense desire. The sense of something, or the experience of something, as pleasant or unpleasant, or neutral. So, for example, there are certain things having to do with other people that feel very pleasurable, including going into sexuality, that feel very pleasurable that we can get driven about, attached to, pushy about, unwise about. So think of this almost as a pre-flight checklist, the non-attachment checklist, okay? It's because we're unattached, then we'll fly, or something like that. Okay, so sense desire, attachment, check, no. Yeah, right, but anyway, for me as well. Okay, also, what's unpleasant? You know, that something happens, we don't like it, it's unpleasant, it's irritating, it's frightening. Those are kind of the big two, irritation or fear, maybe a challenge to a sense of safety. Its alarm bells go off, and then we get activated around it. Now, I want to distinguish here, as I will repeatedly, between, as the Buddha called out the distinction, between a drive state, often translated as craving, a sense of something missing or something disturbed, right? That's different from a wholesome, beneficial wish, a leaning in a good direction without getting upset about it, without getting pressured about it. Major indicators of drive state of craving: sense of pressure, insistence, and lots of self. Me, myself, and I, my precious, and so forth. Okay? So, first category, paying attention to the sense of something is pleasant or unpleasant, how that triggers a kind of upset, or, you know, getting out of balance, losing your cool, going into the red zone, stress reaction, okay? Second main object of attachment is view. View. Our ideas about what's right or what's wrong, or, you know, how other people ought to think. For example, I've seen that a lot around politics, right? I'm just kind of rolling along, and then my son says something, let's say, or somebody else says something, and you know that view is at odds with my view, and the needle starts to move. Then, as Sylvia pointed out, the question is, clock starts. Tick, 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 tick. How long does it take to come back to kind of a basic centeredness in your core? All right? Tick, 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 tick. We're going to get knocked off base. How far do we get knocked off base? And how long does it take to recover? And with repeated practice, we deepen our personal keel of the sailboat we are in the water, so we're stable with bigger and bigger waves or storms. And even if a big one comes along or catches us off guard, whoop, we tend to recover much more quickly. It's a nice way to operationalize, you know, practice. Okay, so view. That's the second main attachment. Some people are more vulnerable, in my view, to getting attached to view than other people are. They tend to be more vulnerable to being righteous or fixated on certain standards. If you know the Enneagram, it's a one often. I'm a social seven. I go to one under pressure. I'm under pressure a lot. So I know that attachment. I think I have at least one of the 10 genes for OCD. So there's like a fixation. And if you make a living by being right about things, in some ways, you know, if you're in a profession that's about that, that rewards accuracy or good advice or whatever, then you're particularly vulnerable. So it's useful to notice one's own vulnerabilities to righteousness of various kinds, or being right, or the need to be the right, or the need to be the knower, the one who knows, the teacher rather than the student. Okay? Second main category. Third main category, and I'm good on time. Traditionally, it's translated as rites and rituals. So locating the Buddha and his lineage 2,500 years ago in the kind of the beginnings or emergent aspects of what we might call today Hinduism, the Jain traditions, which were very focused on rituals of various kinds, which the Buddha described as empty rituals because the focus wasn't on what was in the heart of the person doing the ritual, but the mere performance of the ritual. And you can imagine different sects, different castes, different traditions, people getting attached to their rites and rituals. Rite as in R-I-T-E, not R-I-G-H-T, rites and rituals. A modern version of that, particularly in our more, you know, secular culture, but obviously certain many places that aren't so secular, where people can get attached. I mean, literally, historically, just to pick out, you know, the religion of my childhood, Christianity. I was raised a casual Methodist. We went to church twice a year, usually Easter and Christmas, but anyway. And that said, in the Middle Ages, for example, people would be literally burned at the stake around arguments about, literally, is it Jesus' blood you drink with communion, or is it symbolic of Jesus' blood? Or how many angels can really dance on the head of a pin, right? I mean, people would literally die over fairly tiny disagreements around doctrine, view, okay, or the proper performance of rites and rituals. Today, often this shows up around procedures or like how things ought to go at work or at home, or how the dishes ought to be done, or the dishwasher ought to be loaded, or when people ought to come to dinner, you know, things like that. Or also how other people ought to be, perhaps related to gender norms. Or cultural norms or professional norms. An interesting book I highly recommend if you like this sort of thing, Ancillary Justice, or sometimes pronounced Ancillary Justice. It's a trilogy of science fiction novels that won a lot of awards for good reason. It's beautifully written. And one of the most fascinating aspects of it is that the female personal pronoun is used throughout to describe people. So it's almost impossible to tell in the book itself what the gender of various people is, okay? Or transcending gender, not getting slotted into those kind of narrowing categories. And you can just watch your mind react to, I don't know how you're supposed to be, you know, partly related to that kind of classifying. So anyway, that's another form of thinking about rites and rituals, an attachment to how people ought to be, right? And then the last one, in the Buddha's categories of objects of attachment, is self. right? And self shows up a lot around possessiveness, possession, mine. Okay? My idea, my credit, my contribution, my object, my child, mine. All right? Another major area where we can detect selfing, or the presumed self, the Buddha pointed out, was around identification. We identify with a group. And there's a place for this that's healthy. You know, it's appropriate. If someone started driving away my car, I'd be like, whoa, wait a minute here. You know, not okay, right? You know, and also identification, like there's a loyalty to certain causes or certain groups or to Mother Earth altogether, you know, as Tarani was talking about. And so we can, you know, we identify with what happens there, including the Golden State Warriors, maybe we identify with, right? So there's an okay place, but they can go too far. You know, these like soccer fans beating each other up or other sports fans beating each other up, like that's a little weird. It goes too far, all right? And then last, in terms of selfing, it often shows up around better than or worse than or as good as. And I was just laughing internally at a thing that happened for me. In my mid-20s, I was involved in a human potential organization, and I thought I was pretty cool. You know. And I lived with this guy, and he had a pretty ordinary job, and you know, I just kind of knew I was better than he was. We were roommates. And after about 6 months of increasingly getting on each other's nerves for various relatively small things, we kind of just, and he was sort of floating around the edges of this human potential organization that I was a central figure in, and therefore, obviously, better than him. We decided we had it out. We talked, you know, in an open way. And I had this confession to make, because I was embarrassed about the fact that I just thought I was better than he was, you know? And I said, you know, I got to tell you, I just think I'm better than you are. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and just kind of shook his head. He said, well, I know I'm better than you. And I was like stunned. How could you possibly think that? It's obvious I'm better than you are, you know? I'm like, whoa. And then you step back, talk about watching the mind pop, 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 pop. Oh boy, there were a lot of effervescent bubbles, you know, in my mind right there. And on reflection, and there's that little thing running some often. And the other round of it is less than. I'm less than you. Please, sir, may I have another bowl? Although, what was that, Oliver Twist? He was cool. He thought he was just as good as those people. And give me more oatmeal. But anyway, all right. But we, you know, there can be that kind of beseeching or placating. That's a form of craving, too. You know, we've lost our balance. We're kind of appeasing. You know, the line, fight, flight, freeze, appease. You know, sometimes that's adaptive. You got to do it to get through the situation, maybe, or the relationship, or for the sake of some, you know, hostage to fate, some innocent you're protecting or supporting or something. But often we can get triggered into that one down position, which is in its own certain way, just different valence, but is full of craving as, you know, holding on to and maintaining that one up position. Okay? So quick review, four categories of attachment to be aware of, and kind of like fields or stimuli for tipping into the red zone, tipping into you know, a drive state in which is embedded a sense of something missing and or something disturbed. First being sense pleasure, broadly defined, pleasant, unpleasant, right? Like, dislike. Second, view of various kinds. Third, rites and rituals, or we might say today, routines and roles. And then fourth, classic sense of self. Me, myself, and I. Okay. So being mindful of that is really, really useful. And sort of stepping back even, it might help to do maybe a little journaling or talk with a friend or some reflection. Okay, I'm going to kind of review this relationship and what's going on, you know, through the kind of through the filter of these four inquiries, right? And finishing with a few minutes for questions, comments, we can also be aware of how other people are hooked too, how other people are caught. Well, and then it can refine our understanding of them and help us find a way of responding to them to think about how are they getting triggered. perhaps needlessly, around sense pleasure, pleasant, unpleasant. Like, I often think about that. What's it like for you to be with me? What's my impact on you? Distinct from my intent. My intent could be neutral or benign, but my impact is for you unpleasant. What can, within the range of what's authentically possible for me, what could I do so as I land on you differently, for example? And you could think about the other things as well. How is the other person getting attached to you? Or how could we, for example, help them understand something about how we see things that would reassure them that we're not attacking their view, or that we agree on 99 out of 100 tiles of the mosaic in reality, and our disagreements about just one thing, for example. All right? Okay. All right. Questions or comments? Great.
Rick, I'm wondering if you're making a distinction, or if I'm trying to create an artificial distinction, between being in a drive state, which is probably inherently a neutral thing. Like, I'm going to go paint the bedroom, or I'm going to go fix the car, or I'm going to go get something done, versus the motivation or the attitude you bring to that drive state.
Okay, so great distinction. So, going back to the Buddha, let's say, you know, he basically offered four hypotheses. There is plenty of suffering, distinct from inherent pain. Second, much if not most if not all of that suffering is at bottom caused by craving, which I'm now updating the terminology around, calling it a drive state in an animal biology, including human biology kind of sense. We're driven. And there's a sense in that drive state of something missing, something wrong that we're trying to remedy. The system has been jiggled out of homeostasis. The system of the body or the mind or the relationship or the family or the country has been driven out of a healthy equilibrium, and then it's tipped into some kind of adaptive action to restore healthy equilibrium, right? That's this biology, basically. And then you come back to healthy equilibrium and you kind of roll on out. Why zebras don't get ulcers, right? Okay. Now, sometimes a drive state is necessary, I think. And that, to me, is an interesting exploration. Like, you know, if you're drowning, I nearly drowned one time, trapped in kelp. I was driven to get out of the kelp, you know. You know, there's certain situations where we're a fierce advocate for someone or some cause, and we don't really care if the veins are bulging in our forehead. Deal with it, you know. And then but man, you got to be careful, because there's a lot of collateral damage going into a drive state for yourself and often for other people, right? So I'm willing to call out, especially under certain intense conditions. And I think what gets interesting is to expand the field of challenge that we can handle while staying really peaceful, centered, and happy in our core, right? So, okay. So even if peripherally we're excited, we're active, sympathetic nervous system is activated, in our core, there's a fundamental undisturbed wakefulness. Okay? So that's, you see that, and that distinction is right central to at Buddhist psychology. You could decide for yourself, obviously, does that distinction really mean anything to you? I find it means a lot to me, and I can watch increasingly subtle drive states or tippings into craving. You know, little flares or big flares, and then, you know, what it takes to come back to a peaceful, present, benign, including benevolent toward myself, without a sense of like attaching or clinging to what the next thing is. Okay, so we got the distinction between what I'm calling drive or not drive, the Buddha would call tanha or chanda, you know, thirst or wholesome desire. And you can see for yourself, you can feel the difference. You know, when are you dealing with something from a place of calm, contented strength in your core versus when you're just flooded, reactivated, and then be increasingly aware of subtler and subtler distinctions or versions of that distinction. Okay? Then there's the question of what are we motivated toward, right? And to me, the what's, you know, just they vary, any kind of what we're motivated toward. ranging from, you know, I'd like some more popcorn, to, you know, I'd like some more world peace, right? And then the question, and obviously there are certain desires that it's easy to be pretty chill about. I mean, you're fed, you're fine, you're getting a mani-pedi, and someone says, do you want another cookie? Yeah, you know, that's pretty easy, right? To stay centered and cool when you're dealing with end-of-life decisions for a parent or yourself, that's a really different matter, you know. But I'll just finish on the point that this quote, to paraphrase from Upandita, a Southeast Asian teacher, along the lines of something I already said, he said, the purpose of practice is to expand the range of experiences in which we are free. That just is so psychological, so practical. To me, it's very grounded. You get a feeling for what that means. Okay? All right. Thanks for putting up with the fact that I'm going to leave in a minute after we sit for one more minute. Okay. One more. And you're welcome to leave if you need to rush. You know, I've gone a little long here. So just letting it rest and being, you know, a lot, it's starting to track and flag what's it like to have a mind with no craving or little or no craving. There's no chasing of anything. There's no fighting of anything. Nothing is missing. Nothing is wrong. It's a fairly ordinary mind state. It's often quite common. You reach for the salt. It's fine. There's no problem. You know, you hug your kid. No problem. You know, you get in the car. You turn the key. No problem. What's that like? Okay, let's sit for a minute. Thank you. Thanks for hanging in there with my talk tonight, which zigged and zagged a lot. All right, good. See you next week, I hope. Take care.
You gotta run. Nice to see you.
You gotta have a hug. That was great.
Thank you.
Want a Rick hug?
All good.
I'll stay with this. All right. It's all on tape anyway.